This podcast episode was made possible in part with support from Sacred Rites, a Henry Luce Foundation-funded project hosted by Northeastern University that promotes public scholarship on religion. I highly recommend you learn more about Sacred Rites on their website, sacred-rites.org, that's W-R-I-T-E-S, or find Sacred Rites on Twitter at sacred_rites. Welcome to Classical Ideas. This is Greg Soden. To me, television and film are among the most accessible topics to talk about for people who wish to learn more about the world's religions. Understanding how religion is depicted in the shows and films we watch while relaxing is crucial because of the ways the messages found within those films and shows stick with people and frame their worldviews for years to come. Since becoming a high school religious studies teacher and making this podcast for the last several years, I personally have begun to notice film and television in many new ways that led to positive growth within myself. I'm delighted to have a conversation about such a topic with Dr. Christian Peterson. Christian Peterson is assistant professor in the Department of Philosophy and Religious Studies at Old Dominion University. The topic of our conversation is relevant because he is the editor of Muslims in the Movies, a global anthology, and New Approaches to Islam and Film. He also co-hosts the New Books in Islamic Studies podcast on the New Books Network. On this episode, we first discuss his love of podcasting because we both love podcasting, but then we discuss his article, The Rise of the Muslim Sitcom, out now from The Revealer, and we dive a bit into the work of the television shows Rami, The United States of Al, and the show Chad. We conclude by discussing the importance of public scholarship. You can find Christian Peterson on Twitter at @BabaChristian. I really hope you love this conversation. Thank you so much for listening to Classical Ideas. Dr. Christian Peterson, welcome to Classical Ideas.
Thanks for having me, Greg. I'm excited to talk to you.
I am excited to have you here as well for many reasons, which we'll all get into. And I'm wondering if we can just start off by having you sort of introduce yourself to the audience, however you see fit.
Sure. Well, yeah, thanks again for having me on. It's a pleasure to talk to you. I listen to the podcast a lot, so it's great to be on it as well. So I'm currently a assistant professor, going up for tenure this year. So hopefully that'll go through, fingers crossed.
Yes.
At Old Dominion University in, coastal Virginia. I do mainly, Islamic studies in a couple different areas. Much of my earlier research has been on Muslims in China. And I have a book called Interpreting Islam in China, which looks at the intellectual history of Chinese Muslim scholars who write Chinese language texts on Islamic theology and mysticism and things like that, using the vocabulary of Buddhism and Taoism and Confucianism. So I've been working on that kind of stuff. And then the other stuff I work on is really more Muslims in popular culture and media more specifically. So I teach a course regularly called Muslims in Media, where we look at both journalism and then television and film, and how that helps kind of narrate public understanding about Muslims, and then how Muslim creatives kind of push back against some of those centralized or stereotyped representations through their own productions. And that's kind of the work I've been working on recently.
Wonderful.
And yeah.
You know, I'm curious about the origin of your personal interests in Islam in general, kind of like what doors and pathways led you into this area of interest, which became your profession.
So it was really accidental at first. I took some classes as an undergrad. I went to Stony Brook University on Long Island, where I'm from. And the professors there were just great. I stumbled upon Professor William Chittick, who is kind of one of the foremost scholars on the thinker and mystic Ibn Arabi. Mm-hmm. And took a bunch of courses with him. And then also with Professor Sashiko Murata, who is there. And she is also an Islamicist, but she also taught a lot of courses on things like Japanese Buddhism and, Neo-Confucianism. And they were kind of the heart of the department for me, at least. I kind of majored in the two of them rather than religion or anything like that.
Oh, cool. But
that was great. Spent many afternoon, in their office, sipping tea, just kind of talking with them. And it just kind of, snowballed from there. I didn't really know at the time because I was just kind of taking things that interested me. But I took a course with Professor Murata called Islamic Neo-Confucianism. Mm. And that was basically, we read her first book on these Chinese Muslim authors that I ended up studying. She's kind of the kind of most important author, that works, does scholarship on this tradition. So that, I think that kind of plugged in my memory somewhere. And then I wasn't really sure what to do. So I applied to some graduate schools. Then I got into a couple, but the University of Colorado at Boulder offered me a teaching assistantship. So I was able to go because I got some funding, and there I kind of continued doing both things, like looking at Asian religions, but then also interested in Islam. And, I wasn't really following, I don't know if it's normative, but like a very common path of, graduate study where you kind of hyper focus on something. I kind of was a comparativist and just interested in everything. And, as I started to think about topics to work on for my thesis, I figured focusing on these Chinese Muslims authors was a way to kind of bridge the gap between these kind of seemingly wide and diverse traditions. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of where it started to solidify. I started translating these Chinese language texts for my master's thesis, and then I went on to a PhD at the University of Washington, and I was able to continue focusing on Muslims in China and this kind of very unique intellectual tradition. They just kind of snowballed. It wasn't really well thought out.
I love it. I love it. Well, I got interested in Muslims in China a little bit. I read some of the work of the New York Times journalist and Pulitzer Prize winner, Ian Johnson, who does a lot of work on Muslims in China. And that was really cool. That was sort of an mm-hmm. entry point for me talking about that topic way back in the beginning of the podcast. I think it was like episode like 27 or 29, maybe. But I mm-hmm. found that such a captivating area of interest. And the news the last couple of years with regards to Islam in China has been tragic. And, the attention on Islam in China has been really focused the last couple of years as well. Have you been following? I'm certain you're following the stories out of China with the Uyghur population. Has that been something that you've been keeping your eye on as well?
Yeah, so it's interesting because, it still happens today, but for a long time when people would say, what kind of stuff do you work on? And you say, I work on Muslims in China. People would often say, there's Muslims in China. Like, yeah. There's like a shock to them. Because it does seem, right, there's this kind of impression of what China looks like and what the religions must be there and these kind of things based on kind of public understanding of religion. And my first published article was actually on the Uyghurs, even though I don't really focus on them to the same extent that I focus on Sino-Muslims. So Muslims that live throughout China, they basically look like Han Chinese, they speak Chinese. They're another ethnic minority about the same size in population as the Uyghurs. but I focus basically on them in the pre-modern period. But my first article was actually on kind of diaspora Uyghur groups and how they kind of shaped a public identity for Uyghurs, calling for a native homeland and these kind of things in the kind of earlier days of the movement. And so the past few years where it's really become headlines all over the place, right? United States government's passing legislation about it, and it's in mm-hmm. the news. It's definitely different. And I'm glad that there are lots of experts who know a lot more than I do on the subject to kind of take us to a better understanding on those subjects.
I think I may have to pursue that as a future episode on the show. So if you know any guests that you can tell me about later that might be a good fit for talking about that, I would love to hear more about that and learn just for my own understanding of the situation, because I have a lot to learn on it as well.
Sure.
So, you're appearing here on my podcast, and something that the listeners out there may know about you or may not is that you also are quite a prolific podcaster in your own right. And one of the things that I love doing is having other podcasters on the show now and then, because, after having made like more than 200 of these right now, the amount of episodes behind me is shocking to me when I look back at all the conversations that I've had that have contributed so positively to my own life. It really is boggling to the mind, honestly. And I'm wondering how you feel about podcasting, how you got into it. And I'm just curious about your experience to hear your story with regards to this, this medium that we're currently engaged in.
Yeah, so I've been doing podcasting in some form or another since 2011. And
wow.
Yeah.
Goodness.
Been a while.
Yeah.
I mean, podcasting was a thing at the time, but it certainly it was before like the Adnan serial podcast and before kind of I guess more public and commercial type podcasts were a thing. It was still kind of a weird little part of the internet, but so the way I got involved with podcasting was I was finishing up my dissertation and I got a new job and I was starting my first year of teaching and the same year doing my dissertation. So I figured, why not add something more? Looking back, I don't really understand why I thought that was a good idea. But, in between all of that, I came across the New Books Network. Mm-hmm. And it was, I think it was only kind of a year and a half old or something like that. It was still fairly new. And if people aren't familiar with the New Books Network, it started with the main editor, Marshall Poe.
He's excellent.
He's a great guy. He started, he's a historian of Russia is his background. So he said, let's start this podcast, New Books in History. And so he started doing that and found, somewhat receptive audience. And so he said, this could work for every field and discipline. So let's see if I can help people manage this. And at the time, I think there was a few channels was the way they used to do it back then. So I think there was a pretty regular crew of New Books in Philosophy and maybe a couple other channels that were offering regular things, but there wasn't anything related to religion. So I got in touch with a guy and I just said, hey, what's the deal with this? Like, is there anybody who does this for a religion? And he's like, no, please do it.
Nice.
So he basically said that, you're the person now. So I started then and I started doing podcasts, not as quickly or as regularly as you, but just because of everything else going on. So I focused on New Books in Religion and New Books in Islamic Studies. Basically, they're all kind of talking heads with authors based around recently published books.
Yeah.
And then that kind of opened up some other opportunities. So I was able to work with Marginalia Review of Books, which is part of the LA Review of Books. And they, for a while, had a set of podcasts with a great team that I was able to work with there, which was really cool. And unfortunately, they kind of bailed on the podcast after they changed leadership, after we left the lost the intrepid leadership of Michael Law. So did that for a couple of years. And then that also kind of led to the American Academy of Religion. I was invited to be on the editorial board for Religious Studies News, which is historically been the AAR's kind of main disciplinary newspaper, I guess you could call it, or magazine. I mean, it's for scholars within the guild. And they were revamping that. So as part of that, and then when it went from a kind of print publication to an online publication, there was a lot of conversation about how can we adapt this for this new kind of environment. And some of the folks involved said, let's do a podcast. So we started doing a podcast on basically AAR award winners. So I think the first year we did it on the book award winners, but then also they do some, the AAR gives some grants. So I was able to talk to the grantees about their kind of future project that they got awarded. But then since then, it's been focused primarily on the American Academy of Religion's book award winners, which has been awesome because, you know, I get to read all these wonderful books. So yeah, that's kind of how that's gone. They're all the kind of just nerds talking to each other type podcasts. I would love to do other types, but it's just so much work. And yeah, I don't think I have the technical skill to do anything more. I've tried to, you know, conceive of other projects that would include, you know, multiple voices and kind of my own narrative thread going through it. And it's just, I can't figure it out. I wish I could. I'm not smart enough or something, but yeah, I've done over 300 of these, you know, kind of one-on-one conversations revolving around books, and it's been great. Yeah.
Wonderful. I mean, I'm curious how you see, so the way I see my podcasting is it's like incremental goals for me to learn something new on purpose. Like it builds it into my life so that my life doesn't become like a mental stagnation. So it gives me benchmarks that I can shoot for to where I can learn new things at regular intervals to keep my brain moving forward throughout my life instead of just falling into some kind of, you know, lazy or lackadaisical life habits. But I'm wondering what's rewarding for you about continuing to do these podcast episodes 10 years in.
Yeah, I mean, there's a bunch. I mean, I'm similar that I just have a bunch of different interests and I don't have other outlets to really, like, I don't have the time to just pick up like random books and do things because of teaching and research and all that. So I like that part of it, of course. But there's been, I think, some real tangible benefits in terms of like being an academic and what this has kind of helped kind of foster in my life. So the best part is the kind of making connections. You know, it's one thing to like, even if you write a book review of somebody and you say, this is the greatest book ever, like they'll probably read it and they'll think this is great. And, you know, but that might be the end of the connection. And I'm sure you've found the same thing, but for me, like, you know, I have, you know, 10-year long relationships with people now that are, you know, they're, I don't know how to describe it the best way, but basically they're cheerleaders.
Yeah.
You know, they're excited about me. They think I'm doing great work. They want to see me win, you know, and those have snowballed into other opportunities, I think, that,
yeah.
You know, when I was just kind of getting out of the gate, I didn't really even foresee. So that might be publishing opportunities. That might be, you know, maybe they're, you know, friendly with somebody on a search committee for something or for an editorial board. And, you know, they're, you're in their kind of, you're on their radar, so to speak, in the sense of like they're thinking about you and how you can kind of exist and operate in other contexts. So that's been great. You know, I keep in touch with most people that I do interviews with.
Yeah.
But then more practical things, I guess, as an author, as somebody who writes books and does scholarship, I've found like I have a better gauge of kind of getting at what makes a good book, which I don't think I wasn't thinking about that early on. But after reading lots of books and saying, wow, this book really works, this book's good, you know, or whatever, this is dry, or it could have been better this way. But for me, and especially reading across my research area, so like especially reading like broadly within religious studies, you know, I do Islamic studies, but then focusing on Buddhism or Christianity or Judaism or whatever it might be, seeing how these kind of things operate in different kind of subfields has been really useful.
Awesome.
So thinking about that. And then even just like learning about kind of how book publishing works. Like, I mean, I have tons of people who, you know, are like, what the hell is, how does this all work? Like, I don't know any of this. And like, you know, this is like put me in contact with like a bunch of editors at different presses that I would have never talked to probably, you know, and like understanding, you know, the role of review copies of books, which I don't know if you find, but
so many.
So it's tricky because, you know, new authors, you want to have your book reviewed. And if your press isn't willing to send a copy of the book, which many of them unfortunately aren't anymore. I mean, I get it that it's a money thing, but you know, very often a lot of presses will only send you a digital copy now, and people don't often want to do the labor of reviewing it or those kind of things if they don't get compensated with a book, if nothing else.
Right.
So kind of figuring out a lot of these things that, you know, are kind of key to success as an academic has been really helpful as well. I'm sure there's other things too.
I'm curious if you've seen over the course of the last 10 years, if podcasting as a form of scholarship has kind of like changed your field at all. Have you noticed like people talking about it more at conferences? Have you noticed this becoming something that people actually care about? What have you noticed over the course of your 10 years in podcasting with regards to your field?
Yeah, I think it has changed. So part of when I was doing podcasting early on, it kind of got grouped into like digital humanities work. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, earlier on, it was part of that kind of conversation. And so I was in those spaces. I'd often talk about podcasting. I've also, you know, used podcasting for student projects. So talking about those kind of things.
Yes.
Just like using digital tools more generally. So that's also led me into, you know, kind of being, you know, I don't think podcasting is necessarily digital humanities work, but it's kind of made me a cheerleader of digital humanities work within religious studies, which is kind of a field that's slow to the pickup on that game. So so I've been involved in things related to that. I co-edited a book with Christopher Cantwell on digital humanities and research methods in religious studies. And earlier on, we were, you know, with Chris Cantwell and with others, people like Hussein Rashid involved in organizing that camps, which were kind of these supplementary workshops that happened at the same time as AAR that were focused on digital humanities. So that was part of it. And for a while I would get, you know, invited to talk about like doing it and the benefits of it, of doing podcasting and things like that. And a few years back, there was even Michael Altman wrote a review about podcasting in religious studies. And
nice.
You know, his conclusion was, you know, certainly fair. And basically like this, it's at this point, it's basically just talking heads, which is one thing, but it's not really utilizing everything that the podcast medium can do. And yeah, in the past few years, I mean, there's even more people that are now doing it. I mean, especially since the pandemic, there seems to be kind of like a boom in people saying, oh, let's do this podcast thing.
Yeah.
But I know that Elise Morgenstein First and Megan Goodwin's Keeping It 101, I think is an amazing podcast. It's
really
amazing. Kind of
takes
advantage of, you know, all the kind of key things that we can do with podcasts. It'd be great to hear more kind of narrative podcasts. I don't know if that would be the best way to say it, but there was one that was hosted on the New Books Network. I can't remember it right now, but I think it was Brian. I can't remember. There was a great one on kind of like a deep dive into a particular kind of pre-modern historian. So I think there's space to kind of have these new creative type of podcasts. It still seems that many of them are still just talking heads. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of what makes people like podcasts are the kind of narrative aspect of it, you know?
Yeah.
So like, you know, people listen to all these murder podcasts, but they're all because they're like good stories, you know? And
yeah,
that's one thing that I think a lot of people could take advantage of in making podcasts and religious studies moving forward. But I think it's just a lot of it's the technical part. I mean, it's easy to like, you know, turn on a microphone and push record for this kind of podcast, but it's certainly different when you have multiple inputs of people and you have other elements of music perhaps, or background noise or other things, and you have to kind of time everything out really well. I think it requires skills that most researchers in religious studies aren't kind of developing in their kind of academic training. So
gotcha. Yeah, I've loved watching it as well. And there are several that I listen to within the field. Like I really love Simran Singh's podcast. I love Elise Morgenstein First and Megan Goodwin's podcast. So there's a bunch out there. And then Andrew Mark Henry, obviously his YouTube channel, and Caitlin Ugaritz is doing great work on her.
Yeah, that I really like that kind of move to YouTube. It's been excellent.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about some of your work about Islam and Muslims in the entertainment industry is something that I've read about yours recently. Something that strikes me about this piece that I read of yours recently, it's in The Revealer, and it's called The Rise of the Muslim Sitcom. And to me, the thing that's so important about an article like this is that television is one of the most relatable topics on the planet. It is beamed in directly into the homes of people worldwide in so many languages. And it's just something that is accessible to vast portions of human civilization. So talking about it is really important because it's so relatable to such a wide audience. And in this article, I like the first sentence a lot. It just reads, Muslim television characters have been popping up on television screens lately, and now there are even a few that will make you laugh. And it made me chuckle, but can you articulate how and where Muslims were present in entertainment in years past that might be like a little different to how they're present now? I'm wondering if you can just like kind of talk me through some of the old patterns and maybe work us into the present day a little bit.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, thanks. So this essay was a product of my kind of training in the Sacred Rites cohort, which was excellent. I work on kind of media representations of Muslims more broadly. And then these two television programs just came out, one called Chad and another one called The United States of Al. And they're kind of, you know, there hasn't been a lot of kind of Muslim, what we might call Muslim centered narratives on kind of network television.
Mm-hmm.
In the kind of long history, which I won't kind of go in a deep dive, but, you know, before 9/11 in the past, there were not tons of representations of Muslims. Often Arabs and Muslims are conflated and understood as the same thing, even though, of course, there are Arab Christians, Arab Jews, and then, of course, lots of Muslims who aren't Arab. There was, you know, a lot of work done by people like Jack Shaheen and then Evelyn L. Sultani, who've kind of demonstrated that, for the most part, pre-9/11 images were rather stereotypical, whether they be, you know, based in kind of narratives related to like the oil embargo or the Iranian Revolution or these kind of things. But there was never really like Muslim stories being told. And then after 9/11, there was kind of a, I don't know, it seems a little unexpected, perhaps. There was a kind of increase in representation. And in addition to kind of negative representations, at this point that mainly kind of reproduced a kind of terrorist trope or violence trope, there was also these kind of quote unquote positive representations of Muslims. So kind of in that period, you can think of shows like Homeland or 24 that were, you know, still rooted in the kind of war on terror. So so Evelyn L. Sultani is the person who I follow on this. She's great. And basically she argued that these kind of positive representations are still limited, right? They're still anchored to a war on terror narrative, in the sense that a positive, right, or a quote unquote good Muslim on television is going to be one who's fighting against the terrorist, or perhaps they're an informant, or they're, you know, in the FBI or in the CIA as a translator, or, you know, or maybe they're even the victim of some other, you know, extremist action, right? But they're still always put within this kind of war on terror framework. I think from, you know, this has started to change, I guess, a little bit in the past few years, although it's still continued, right? So there's shows like Jack Ryan that just came out a couple years ago that kind of do the same type of thing. But there's been a kind of a reframing where Muslim creatives are able to make narratives that are just about life, right? They're in the same way that there's programs about, you know, white men or right or white women that range the spectrum, right? There's good ones, there's bad ones, there's people in the middle, there's right some that have nothing to do with kind of any kind of moral character. But so, you know, there's just kind of shows now that are starting to come out that are just about people that happen to be Muslims, right? And being Muslim like shapes their lives in very particular ways, but that's not the kind of sole characteristic that they should be understood with. So Rami is a really great example of this kind of like new Muslim television.
Yeah, it's great. I've seen all of them.
Yeah, so Rami's a really interesting example because you know, he's been very clear as a creative that he doesn't want to try to, he's not trying to tell everybody's story, right? He's trying to tell his very particular story as a American of Egyptian descent who lives in New Jersey, right? Within a very particular context. And part of the problem, which I point to a little bit in the essay, is that because there's so few of these types of shows, there's kind of a burden of representation on Muslim creatives to satisfy everybody.
Right.
And of course, Muslims are very diverse, right? They have a whole spectrum of ideas about what being a Muslim is and what the values are and their experiences. And those are shaped by gender and race and ethnicity and, you know, all sorts of stuff. So, so these shows, they have to do a lot, I think, in terms of their audience reception. The audiences want a lot to happen through them, and it's nearly impossible to kind of satisfy everybody. So Rami's interesting because he's basically kind of like just set the path and said, like, this is the story I'm telling, right? Like, I'm not going to satisfy everybody. And there's been tons of people who really tons of Muslim spectators who say this show is horrible. right? This is not the representation we want. If you've seen the show, right, you could probably guess some of the things of why they would think that. But it is interesting, right? Because it is centering a very authentic Muslim voice, right? We can't deny that Rami is, right? Islam is central to his understanding of self and his understanding of community. And so it's all wrapped up in this. And there's a few other shows like this that have been starting to come out. In Britain, there's a couple of really good shows that I like. One called Man Like Mubin. Another one came out recently called We Are Lady Parts. There was another Canadian production called Sort Of that just came out about a trans Muslim of South Asian descent. It's a great show. So they present these narratives that are about real people, right? They're not victims of, you know, Islamophobia, or if they are, like, that's not the whole reason for the show, right? And they're not, in the war on terror fighting against, you know, Muslim extremists or something like this. So they're kind of breaking this post 9/11 framework that says you're either a bad Muslim and you're a terrorist, or you're a good Muslim and you're fighting against the terrorists. And that was basically the bounds of representation that were possible at that time. So it's been great because there's now these kind of new creatives who are kind of expanding the boundaries in really interesting ways.
Yeah, Rami was a shocking series for me to watch because there are, like, he puts so much of his own imperfection clearly on display right at the front, and it just feels like it, you know, was like a challenging show to make. And that's what I loved so much about it. Did you enjoy it that way too?
I liked Rami a lot. Yeah. I thought it was, it's hard when your interests like kind of are wrapped up in your research as well, but I liked it for several reasons, but one, I like that kind of, specificity of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is something that, helps narratives kind of hit with people. And it might seem ironic, right? Like that the specificity of a Egyptian American kid from New Jersey, right? Like that story is going to be, you know, quote unquote universal in many ways. But yeah. I think that's the types of stories that I think work the best is when they kind of really, kind of hone into their specificity, at least in my experience. The other thing that I like about Rami a lot is that it seemed that, Rami is one person, there's a whole creative team there. Mathil Hassan is one of the writers and producers of that show too. And she's a scholar in her own right of Muslims in media. And I think their whole team, I think listens to audiences, which seemed to be really, really interesting because, they definitely made a lot of transitions going from season one to season two in thinking about whose voices get to be told in the show. The first season was very much about Rami, and the second season really expands out to those in his sphere, right? The other people in his life. And they tell stories about Muslims that are, questioning their sexual identity. And they did a very good job, I think, of bringing in kind of the racial diversity of Muslims in America by bringing in Mahershala Ali and his family in the show. So I think they're also really exemplary in the sense that they're attentive to kind of this burden of representation, right? They take it seriously in the sense that they want to tell their particular story, but they want to tell that in a kind of diverse kind of world that perhaps is not easy to achieve. So you're right, it does seem like a difficult show to produce.
Yeah, well, and a lot of things you just said relate to something that you wrote in the article as well. And you talk about asking who these shows are for, And I'm wondering if you can just like elaborate a little bit on that, because I found that comment in the article to be extremely fascinating.
Yeah. So, for me, the kind of question of like, is this a positive representation? Is this a negative? I mean, there's bearing to that, of course, right? There are things that are certainly like overtly negative and will have, you know, kind of bad social consequences if that type of image is reproduced. But, for the most part, if people are telling their own personal stories, how can we say that that's a bad representation, right? So, for example, just to kind of go off track a little bit, There's this film called Hala, which was one of the first films with Apple Television. Mm-hmm. It was an Apple Television film, and it was written and directed by an American, South Asian Muslim filmmaker, and it's largely autobiographical. Mm-hmm. And takes a lot from her own experience. But it does reproduce a lot of kind of ideas or assumptions or stereotypes from the kind of archive of media representations, if we can think of it that way, right? This 100+ years of cinema and television, there are certainly tropes that were present. And in this film, which perhaps is reflective of her life, some of those tropes came out. And so there was a lot of people that were like, this film is not what we want. This is not the type of Muslim representation we want. But to say that those are negative, right? This is her story, so to speak, right? She's kind of telling her own narrative. And just because it aligns with some of those stereotypes, that's part of her reality as a creative. So that's kind of what led me to think about when these types of productions, these Muslim-centered narratives are being creative, like, I think the audience has to be taken into consideration, right? Like, so who is this for? So with Hala, for example, the people who thought this was a great film were lots of like non-Muslim audience, white liberal kind of Hollywood audiences. Mm-hmm. That this is great, right? Muslim director and writer and all these things, right? Diverse cast. There's all these things that are great about it. But so for that audience, it was a win. But for some Muslim audiences, right? There's certainly Muslims that enjoyed it, but for some Muslim audiences, there was a lot of uneasiness about it, right? There's tensions in how do we receive this film that's supposedly representing us. And so for me, I then said, who are these things being made for? And it seems, I got to do more research on this, but it seems that in network television, part of what structures the possibilities is the people who watch network television, which I think certainly is a different demographic than a show like Rami, which is streaming on Hulu, right?
Yeah.
So people that are, cut the cord and have Hulu or Netflix or other shows or other programs, right? They might be into different types of narratives, different types of possibilities. But I think a kind of CBS type, NBC network television type of audience, as you said, right, again, streaming into people's houses just for having cable, they might have different expectations and different assumptions about Muslims. And in my reading of these two shows, United States of Al and Chad, I think they are working with those kind of assumptions of that audience. And some of the people behind these have said that, even if they are reproducing perhaps some of the tropes, so like, for example, United States of Al is about a Afghan interpreter who comes to America because of his white U.S. military partner. Mm-hmm. Basically helps him get to America, and he lives with him, and he kind of helps him in his post-military life. So the show, while it's also about this Afghan subject, Al. It's also very much about being in the military, right? What is it like to be a post-military person? It's kind of a middle America type generational show in the terms of like the son and the father both have similar experiences with war and being in the military. So it's couched in those kind of themes of previous productions that included Muslims, mm-hmm. right? In the war on terror, these kind of things.
Gotcha.
But the creatives, right, they say, like, even though we have to kind of enter into this area that perhaps we wouldn't want to, this is going to open up possibilities of reaching a broader audience and doing things like introducing them to Afghan culture, right? In terms of dress, in terms of language, in terms of food. I understand why people would want to do that. The United States of Al is getting like millions and millions of viewers, mm-hmm. which is great. And it does have, several Afghan writers in the writer's room for the show. It has several cast members of some sort of West Asian ethnicity, which is great. They do show a kind of diverse range of kind of attitudes towards the Afghan war. So while the show focuses on Al, who was very much part of it, right, being an interpreter, it also has characters that are very much against U.S. Imperialism. Right, so it does kind of show this diversity. I think most of these decisions are shaped based on who it's for, right? Mm-hmm. They're saying, this show really isn't for Muslims, so to speak, right? We want to reach a broader audience and kind of disrupt their assumptions about Muslims. And the way we can do that is kind of coming through this back door of kind of a war on terror narrative.
Yeah, well, and I was also thinking recently about the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan and the immigration challenges for so many of the people who, assisted the U.S. military in some way during the last 20 years. And I'm wondering if there's anything that anything like that from recent events that have, pushed your own thinking on the United States of Al or a show like that. Is there anything that you've thought about since the U.S. has kind of like had this recent major shift in military endeavors in Afghanistan itself?
Yeah, well, one of the things that, in thinking about this toss-up of, presenting Muslim-centered narratives, but then also kind of buying into a kind of broader American narrative that kind of structures how stories can be told, by making that choice of being on network television, when the withdrawal from Afghanistan was happening, this show, United States of Al, was able to react to it almost immediately. And the second season opener actually focused on this. So it focused on kind of a story about Al trying to get his sister out and getting his family out. And I think it was one of the first these kind of sitcoms that didn't use a laugh track in all the whole episode. And it dealt with this topic in a very kind of sensitive and kind of compassionate way. And in that context, that probably did a lot of help in thinking for non-Muslim American audiences to think about what's going on there, right? And how ideas about U.S. imperialism, negatively affect people around the world. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't know if that happens. I guess I'm an optimist in the end, in hoping that these kind of things can do that. I don't know if I would make the same choices to say, let's make a show about an Afghan interpreter from the war. But I think there are opportunities by taking that pathway of kind of trying to reach, broader non-Muslim audiences to kind of disrupt or, shake down stereotypes about Muslims.
Yeah.
Similar to the sense of like, well, why do we teach? Like, you know, in theory, I imagine that if people are more knowledgeable about Muslims, they will be, you know, more sympathetic, right? More compassionate. You know, they won't kind of reproduce stereotypes or even, you know, anti-Muslim, you know, rhetoric or violence or these kind of things. So, you know, I think it's the same underlying principle. So in that sense, I try to be optimistic, but yeah, it's hard to say if that kind of approach is effective in the end. I don't
gotcha.
Know.
Well, a show that I haven't gotten a chance to see yet is Chad, and you do offer some commentary on that show within the character within your article. But the thing that really struck me about your article about Chad is that the main character expresses embarrassment and just wants to very much seem to fit in. And, you know, this is a feeling that I've never really had to struggle with a whole lot. And I'm curious about your perceptions on how the character who is Muslim talking about how being Muslim makes them feel incompatible with American life can have, you know, consequences for viewers who see such messages. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's another kind of tricky balance and one that is going to affect viewers in different ways. So Chad is about a teenage boy who's going to high school, doesn't fit in. He's of Iranian background. His father is abroad. He doesn't have contact with him. And he's kind of just like an obnoxious person. Like, he's a very unlikable character, very kind of cringe inducing character. And he is very conscious of being of, you know, West Asian heritage, right? Being different. But he, at least in my reading, seems that this is a hurdle to his greater inclusion in what he sees as cool, right? In his high school. You know, it's something that's kind of holding him back. And he largely rejects not only being Muslim, which they expressly say in the show, right? His mom says, right, well, we're technically Muslims. And he's like, I don't want to be Muslim, right? I don't want to be Middle Eastern. I want to, you know, fit in. So there is this kind of tension, and, you know, that kind of narrative, I'm sure, is one that resonates with a lot of people, a lot of people that perhaps had similar, you know, experiences growing up or even today. So it's the same type of thing. I don't want to say that, you know, this is a bad show or this is bad representation, because it's reflective of the creator's story, right? And one that I'm sure resonates with people, but certainly not with everyone. And in both shows, I think part of what can happen is that, you know, there's a risk in kind of trying to be authentic and almost in the sense of, like, you know, airing out dirty laundry, right? That there are certainly within every community critiques that can be made, right? Things that can be better.
Of course.
But if you do that to this kind of public viewing, right, some people might say, well, that's too much, right? We already have it bad enough in the way we're represented. We shouldn't have Muslims now, you know, making this claim or that claim that kind of make us look bad. But it's an interesting show because it does kind of, you know, walk the same line. It pushes back on some stereotypes, but it also it might not be what many Muslim viewers want.
Gotcha. Well, Christian, I'm really, you know, excited by a lot of the work that you're doing, because what you're talking about throughout this conversation, like I said earlier, is just relevant to anybody that consumes media, who sits down at the end of the day, wants to unwind a little bit, turns on the TV. And what you're doing, to me, is helping everybody think about what it is that they are consuming on any given day that may have a broader impact on our worldviews as we go through our real lives talking to, you know, strangers. So to me, that's what's so essential about the kind of stuff that you're doing. And I love the fact that you are really committed to bringing these ideas and these conversations to a wider audience through, you know, a lot of your public scholarship. And the reason that you and I finally got together after, you know, we could have done this years ago at this point, which is hilarious, but you're a member of the 2021 Sacred Rites cohort. And I've been talking to pretty much everybody in your cohort, and it's been just an absolute pleasure for me. But you've been doing podcasting for so long. You talk about film and television and entertainment, which is relevant to everybody in the world. And, you know, I'm curious about your thoughts on the relevance of doing public-facing work through something like Sacred Rites, but also in your podcasting and wide-ranging publications. You know, tell me your thoughts about the importance of reaching people in the world that are outside of academia for you.
Yeah, I guess early on, I never really thought of the podcasting in that framework. It was kind of just something that seemed like an exciting opportunity for me, and I just kind of got into it. But as I've and probably something I couldn't really frame as an early career scholar in a way that that would have been valuable to me, to be honest. Mm-hmm. A lot of people probably saw podcasting as like a hindrance to doing, you know, quote unquote real scholarship.
Sure.
So I mean, that's certainly something that for other academics that might be listening is that, you know, it's hard to do public scholarship when you're you know, or if you are on the tenure track or right, these kind of things that, you know, the people that are going to be assessing you are might privilege over other things, right? You know, journal articles, books, these kind of things. They might not see public scholarship as really valuable. Mm-hmm. I've come to think of it as a much more effective way of kind of putting our knowledge to use, though, to be honest. And the podcasting has been great, you know, because over the years, people, you know, anytime I'm at a conference, I love the new books podcast is great. It's so amazing. You know, people seem to really love it. And, you know, in that sense, I see the podcast as an avenue to bring people's research to people that aren't going to get to read their books, right? There's only so much you can read. Yeah. There's a lot of, you know, in many subfields, there's like already more than enough to read at any given moment.
Yeah.
So if you ever want to think about anything that's even adjacent to what you're doing, it's like nearly impossible. So, you know, I think it's helpful to, like, you know, people that are working on Islam in South Asia to hear what's going on about, you know, in, you know, Southeast Asia or in East Asia, for example, right? And they might not pick up a book like mine, but if they can listen to an interview about it, you know, that can perhaps spark something, right? Or they'll maybe say, oh, I do need to pick this up, right? Because they're doing a similar thing, or they're taking a similar approach. I need to check this out. So for me, the podcast has really become a great way of kind of spreading knowledge. And, you know, I try to do a similar thing to you, Greg, that, you know, it's just about kind of, you know, I'm not trying to critique people. No book is perfect.
Right.
But I think there's so many valuable things about the stuff people are working on that I want to help share and spread that. And then through Sacred Rites, I was able to get some more know-how about how to do this in a more kind of regular way, right? And take other, you know, avenues. So I'm excited. I'm going to try to continue, working, doing public facing work. You know, it's harder, but especially with the media context, and even with the kind of re-centering of, stories about Muslims in China, it's really been a moment where, you know, I can do this. So I wrote almost a historical explainer on the anniversary of 9/11 about how, the Chinese government adopted language from the war on terror after 9/11 to kind of work against Uyghurs. So I was able to kind of do that. And then I've been able to kind of, write stuff like this piece we were talking about today that focuses on, in a much more kind of immediate and quick way, things related to my research. So
what are you paying attention to next and working on?
I am just trying to stay alive, my friend, and not go crazy, to be honest. So, it's been a difficult couple of years. I mean, to be totally real, I'm just trying to stay afloat for the most part.
Right.
You know, get my classes working, attend to my students who are struggling with all sorts of stuff. Keep my kids happy and, you know, my wife and those kind of things. But the things I am excited about and hoping to work on and try to do every once in a while is the kind of main, or I don't even know what's main anymore, but there's kind of a couple avenues towards similar ideas. But one is this idea of Muslim cinema, thinking about film that's informed by interpretations of Islam, whether that is in its production by creatives or by its consumption by audiences, in the sense that Islam is structuring how those things are created or consumed. And so the kind of idea is a kind of larger book project that looks at a whole bunch of context and comparison from places like Indonesia and Iran to Nigeria or Morocco, but also places like France and Canada and the United States, and can we conceive of something that we might call Muslim cinema? So that's kind of one thing I'm working on. And then I'm also really interested in what we might think of as Muslim movie stars. Mm-hmm. So I've been for a while now, I've been kind of thinking and writing a little bit about people like Mahershala Ali and Riz Ahmed, and thinking about what does it mean to be a movie star and Muslim, right? And how does that get played out within the selection of roles, within stories that get told, but then also in the kind of the larger social context, like how do they support other creatives? Both Mahershala Ali and Riz Ahmed are now producers. How do they help Muslim stories get told? How can they use their celebrity to engage in activism type work? So for whatever reason, those two figures kind of stand out for me, and I've been kind of thinking about how to think about their lives and activities in complex ways. So.
Excellent. Well, Dr. Christian Peterson, I have really enjoyed this conversation today, and I'm, you know, curious to keep exploring work with you, but also to continue to incrementally dive through your massive back catalog of fantastic podcasts. There's so many that you can listen to online, and so it just takes me a while, but I like to go through these whenever I'm on runs and just kind of out on a walk and things like that. So I'm glad that you have so much out there for people to check out. Can you just remind listeners where to find all of your work if they are looking to follow you in various ways?
Sure. Well, I'm on Twitter, of course. Mm-hmm. My handle is at Baba Christian, and Christian is KRISTIAN. So at Baba Christian. And then I have, I try to keep my website up to date. That's just drchristianpeterson.com. And I do have a page focused on podcasts there, though, with links to all the podcasts that I've done. But New Books Network also is a great place that we actually have a really good team of co-hosts for New Books in Islamic Studies to New Books in Religion. And so there's lots of great stuff there, too.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to be here with me today. It means a lot that I could kick off my 2022 podcasting year together with you today.
Yeah. Thanks, Rick. Happy New Year.